Hello, welcome to What We Just Watched from TV Cream.
I'm Ian.
And I'm Chris. And today, we're going to start with my choice of programme. Ian, now I'm sure you will guess straight away what this show is.
Okay.
So maybe you can just identify it and then maybe talk about what we're seeing on screen.
Yep.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, fantastic. It's probably Saturday Night Live, is it?
It is Saturday Night Live. What are we seeing?
We're seeing a succession of images from around the world. Oh, there's George Bush Sr. I think we get that we've had the Pope. I think there's a silhouette of Clive himself. There's the Pope. You see, I'm already anticipating what's coming up. Oh, this is a great choice.
So now we're going to watch Saturday Night Clive. So we've just watched an edition of Saturday Night Clive, first broadcast on BBC Two on Saturday the 4th of March 1989. So Ian, when I pressed play, what were you hoping to see?
I was hoping to see all the things that I remember most fondly about the programme first time round, which were plenty of topical references, gags about the week's news,
yes,
preferably involving some picture captions or some interaction with clips.
Yes.
I was hoping that we'd get a foreign correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me? Vitaly Vitaliev.
Of course. Yeah.
Another thing I always associate with the programme is Clive had a curious obsession with ageing Hollywood beauties who were in a sort of advanced state of disrepair.
Such as?
Jackie Stallone was one. She was always in it. And
yes.
Jar Jar got bored.
Of course.
Speaking barely any trace of English. There'd be a studio guest,
yeah,
of course. Now, I always remember most enjoying the likes of Stephen Fry,
yeah,
Victoria Wood,
yeah,
Peter Cook,
yeah,
a sort of conversationalist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then also some clips, international clips,
yeah,
which
yeah,
were always Clive's sort of calling card, wasn't it?
They, yeah, they,
him and his team had unearthed some obscure adverts,
yeah. Yeah.
And some, usually some footage of an American network,
yeah,
doing some preposterous kind of live event, which at the time and still now would seem such a odd,
yeah,
peculiar, perverse thing to televise. And I'm happy to say,
yes,
Chris, that most of those items appeared in this edition.
Oh, well, they did. That's absolutely what we got, isn't it?
Save for Vitaly Vitaly.
Hello, Clive. I am the media.
So let's talk about the titles, because they're brilliant, aren't they?
They're fantastic.
Yeah, they're very much of their age, aren't they?
Completely.
It's a bit Network 7. So it's kind of this kind of montage of famous faces as Margaret Thatcher and Frank Bruno and George Bush.
Yes, and the Pope.
And the Pope. Riding wall. Celluloid. And we also get sort of Clive James. He's almost rapping at the end, isn't he?
That's the pièce de résistance. Just at the end, you've had all these flashing lights and visuals and stuff, and then suddenly the man himself.
Yeah.
First of all, he appears in silhouette.
Yes.
In a sort of classic pose, in an armchair with
a remote control.
Zapping.
Which is almost kind of like a visual device for the show. The show is almost kind of zapping between channels,
that's
isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes. And then we have this little bit of rapping. What's he saying there?
He just sort of says pulsing, writhing wall of celluloid, or it's kind of,
well, I think that's a quite fitting description though for what we're about to see. Now, I know it's a bit odd to hear Clive even attempting to do a bit of rap, but I think it kind of gets away with it in the context of all this jamboree of visuals and sounds.
Welcome once again to the BBC's first deregulated, fully sponsored, lead-free, unrefrigerated, environment-friendly television programme, produced in conformity with the new broadcasting guidelines.
So the show opens with Clive delivering a kind of succession of jokes, which in his usual style, there's lots of out-of-context footage of famous politicians and celebrities and kind of caption jokes.
America's vice president estimates the size of his own brain.
Now, Clive always claimed that he invented this style
of humour. Do you go along with?
I think that's fair, because this predates the likes of Have I Got News For You?
Yeah.
Which kind of brought that idea of, we'll say a line, and then the picture is nothing to do with the line, but because it's because there's a dislocation there, that's the humour.
Yeah.
It's almost kind of like sort of a bogus headline.
Yes, yeah.
He was doing that kind of stuff. Clive was doing that stuff way back in the early 80s. But when he started, before this, he was on ITV with Clive James on television.
Yeah.
If that made you feel like a defenceless oyster, it did so in just 15 seconds.
And he also had a Channel 4 show, The Late Clive James.
Good evening and welcome again to the show which attempts to prove, against all the odds, that there is a place for a balding, overweight Australian on television.
Which is a kind of a prototype of this, where we had a brief topical monologue followed by guests. And I think what he's done here is sort of meld those two bits together into a big sort of showcase.
Yeah, yeah.
For all of his, it's like armoury of material.
So it's 1989, isn't it? So what do we get that tells us we're in 1989?
We get pretty much everything you'd expect for and hope for. I made a list of some of the jokes and the references.
Yeah.
The SDP, the M25, Sky. I mean, he's obsessed with Sky.
Yeah. Well, at this point, you could always just get a cheap laugh out of Sky's audience figures.
Sky Television's audience is already in double figures. And their ratings are shortly expected to reach the critical point where new viewers are added faster than the old ones die of boredom.
So there's Sky, CFCs.
Yes.
The environment, of course, is a big thing. Edwina Curry.
Yeah.
And eggs.
Yeah.
British Rail.
Yeah.
Oliver North and Dan Quayle.
Well, Ian, I would also add to your list, there's a brief appearance by Lord William Rees-Mogg.
Of course, of course.
Our success in providing a 45-minute television oasis free from sexual innuendo today drew this tribute from broadcasting watchdog Lord Rees-Mogg.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, my lord.
And we forget how big a deal Mr. Sir Lord William Rees-Mogg was in the late 80s.
Well, he was one of those people who you could just get a laugh out just by saying their name.
And I think his job at this point was some sort of unofficial or official regulator of standards.
I think now you would call him a broadcasting czar, wouldn't you?
Yes, but he standards
czar. But he was this kind of watchdog figure who kind of, you know, any comedian would sort of claim that he would, you know...
Always watching, you better be careful.
Yeah.
And indeed... at one point, an alarm goes off in Clive's studio.
Visiting British VIP learns Venezuelan state secrets. Yes, Lord Rees-Mogg.
To denote that Sir William has intervened to put a halt to a bit of smut.
Yeah, I do take your point, my lord. Yeah. Okay, see you at the James Last concert.
Now, there's one reference which I think is actually slightly outdated by 1989, is that Clive keeps suggesting that every sort of piece of technology within the show has been made by Clive Sinclair. He talks about the Sinclair satellite. At one point, there's a reference to a Sinclair pedal-operated generator. I think Sinclair kind of jokes were out by 1989, weren't they?
There is one thing that you can always criticise Clive for, and this was true throughout his career, is that he liked to hold on to obsessions and gags a little bit too longer than was necessary.
I think you're right.
And he would revisit them years after they'd passed their sort of peak popularity. I mean, it doesn't crop up here, but I remember his obsession with Yasser Arafat, or Yasmin Arafat, as she was dubbed. Norman Schwarzkopf was another. Kurt Waldheim was another. These were individuals from the news.
Their currency had dwindled.
It had long been spent by the time. And yet, I suppose he kind of thought that the humour could be mined simply from keeping on going about them.
Well, let's talk a bit about the set.
It's a brilliant set.
Yeah. So it's basically Clive, a desk, and a video wall. Now, do you think this is the start of the video wall on British television?
Oh, absolutely. And I think we can justifiably give Clive credit here for popularising the idea of someone sitting in front of a big wall of screens on television.
Yeah.
It's a thrilling thing. Yeah. I mean, I remember at the time being fascinated by this idea that you could see television screens on television.
We should say that, though, he doesn't call it a video wall, does he? What does he call it?
He calls it his wonder wall.
He does, doesn't he?
Again, sort of slightly preempting the popularisation of that phrase.
Yeah.
The gag is that this wall, it's there, but obviously he speaks to people through it.
Mm.
guests appear on.
He sort of reclines in his chair when he's.
It's a pose which suits him. Gazing upon this giant wall. Yeah. But there's a gag which doesn't quite work.
As you know, our Wonder Wall is designed to fill the background with interesting images for those young people who are confused by the programme's verbal element.
Which is that when the wall is not being used for guests, it defaults to pictures of the boring things with a line of seagulls on posts.
And there's a chess match as well, isn't there?
After we screened our video of the chess match between the two catatonic Russian grandmasters, Viktor Sleepov and Igor Ziz.
Viktor Sleepov and Igor Ziz.
With a name like Viktor Sleepov, you can't go wrong with a name like that, can you? And quite rightly, he uses it several times during the programme. Yeah. But we don't see them, do we? All we see is a chessboard, which is a joke, isn't it?
It's a throwaway, isn't it?
Will George Bush be successful at promoting himself as a human being? Or will he continue to be regarded as a plaster effigy that used to stand beside the ghost train at Disneyland, vaguely waving a rubber tomahawk at passing trains?
So the first person that Clive says, "Can you hear me?" to is his Washington correspondent, Simon Hoggart.
Simon Hoggart, can you hear me?
So where do we see him?
We see him sitting in front of a large colour slide of, well, he's in America.
Yeah, it's
so
in Washington.
It could only ever be either a Statue of Liberty, I suppose the Golden Gate Bridge, or Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
And it's the Capitol building. But he's, we don't see this on television anymore, do you? A person sitting in front of a static image. There's nothing to really imply that he's there, other than the fact that we've had the caption by satellite.
Yeah. So it's March 1989, isn't it? So George Bush Senior has just been sworn in as president. So Clive and Simon, their chat is exclusive about George Bush, and they sort of talk about how he sort of lived up to his predecessor Ronald Reagan, and they talk about a lot of the way he communicates and the language he uses.
He sounds pretty good, doesn't he? As long as you're not listening.
He talks in a kind of weird Bush speak. You would need a Berlitz course, I think, to fully understand it. The point is that very often it doesn't have any verbs. In effect, you're paddling in the president's stream of consciousness. So he'll say things like, hey, it's that vision thing.
Yeah, it's interesting that they don't really dwell on policies or politics of it.
Mm.
Clive's interested in language and presentation and things like that. It's fascinating, though, to get this little glimpse of life at the start of the Bush presidency, knowing what was to come over the next 4 years.
Yeah.
We've already got the idea established that Bush is nowhere near as much of a character as his predecessor.
You know, they used to call him a wimp, but there's a better technical term in use here, which is he's a nerd. Now, the point about a nerd is he thinks he's one of the boys.
Simon gets a big laugh, doesn't he, when he refers to George Bush as being a nerd.
Well, the audience are really engaged with this, and throughout the programme, I have to say, it's a very sympathetic audience. They laugh at all of the gags. Even when there's nothing really funny going on, you can hear them tittering in the
background. Do you think nerd hadn't quite come into sort of popular currency at this point? That's why they find it funny.
Well, they're laughing at something which is unfamiliar. It sounds a bit, and it sounds like vaguely offensive. Ooh, a nerd. And so they're giggling.
Yeah.
And also the idea that perhaps there's still a sort of sense of, oh, you can't really say that about a president of the United States.
So I was going to say, Simon's very good value, isn't he? Because he kind of got this feeling that he's kind of quite a bit of a sort of journalistic insider. He talks about being at the White House the day after Bush was sworn in.
Mind you, the Chinese really looked after him. At one of the official banquets, they were served a dish, boar's penis soup. And as I'm sure you know, the Chinese believe that you take on the attributes of what you eat. Now, of course, I know that Bush would hope that this would increase his virility, but I suspect it would merely serve to make him more of a bore.
So despite all this kind of sort of political insider chat, another big laugh Simon gets is when he refers to Bush going to an engagement in China and isn't he served boar's penis soup.
Well, that's another thing, isn't it? As soon as you drop the word penis into conversation, you're going to get an audience on your side.
Yeah.
And the idea as well of a president eating a penis is something which, even today, as we can hear, is going to produce laughter.
I think that's also a bit of a hallmark of Clive James's shows, is that kind of, despite kind of all the kind of sort of political satirical material, sometimes you will just get a knob gag.
Well, this is This is one of the things that I've always liked about him, is that he's not afraid, Clive, to range between the two extremes, sort of very high cultural ideas, literature, philosophy, and also what we would call quite sort of low. But it's actually, it's just valid, because there's humour in both of them, and his brilliance is the way that he shifts quite happily and nonchalantly between both of them. And it's, as you say, he's not afraid to swerve into a smut whenever the opportunity arises.
One thing that this chat with Simon Hoggart illustrates about the whole show is that there is not one moment of spontaneity within it. The entire thing is scripted, isn't it? Or at least worked out in advance. Does that matter?
That's true, but I don't think it does. I would rather have everything carefully planned and scripted as it is, than for it to be too loose and vague and unstructured and not be as funny as the programme is. Okay, yeah, it might look stilted and contrived to us.
I don't think it does. You can see the script sort of
scrolling through Clive's head,
yeah,
can't you?
But it doesn't affect it, or you don't think any less of it.
That's correct.
So then we move on to another staple of the Clive James shows, which is a clip from a funny foreign TV show.
The contest is called the Mother-Daughter Pageant, and it's got a stage full of mothers and daughters all proving that there is no such thing as age as long as you have love, tenderness, and a surgically assisted smile.
From across the nation, please welcome the finalists of the 1989 Mother-Daughter Pageant.
And the clip we get, it goes on forever, doesn't it? So there's kind of two competitors who are mother and daughter from each state in the USA. You just have to imagine an incredibly cheesy, outdated 1980s beauty contest, and that's it.
Even for the late 80s, it's incredibly tacky and tasteless and crass. I mean, it really belongs, well, arguably it doesn't belong on television at all, but it feels like it's something that really came from the 70s or even the 60s. But, yes, not one point during this clip do we hear anything from Clive. Not at all.
The entire clip and the humour that lies within the kind of the awfulness of the show is just left to stand for itself. Yeah. You know, if someone was showing that on TV now, after 6 seconds they would butt in with a funny line. But they know that the material is strong enough. And that this terrible show, you can see that you can write your own jokes. Yes.
There's this thing about these sorts of programmes, and I remember it well, that they'd have this sort of vague air of not really coming from this world, almost. They had sort of otherworldly, exotic nature.
That was, I think, one of the appeals of Clive James's shows, is that, you know, this is the only place where you could see, you know, TV from abroad. And, you know, now I think kind of that's the sort of stuff that kind of you would see on YouTube, isn't it?
Stephanie, I understand that you're a real animal lover. What's the most unusual pet you ever raised?
Well, I'm raising right now a gray squirrel, and I've had him for 10 years.
How'd you find him?
His tree was cut down, and I made it come over and said there are 5 baby squirrels laying out in the yard. And would you like to take one?
What did you think about the way the audience reacted to that footage of the mothers and daughters in the pageant?
That's a good question, because I felt at times a bit unsettled by their response, because there's a lot of laughter and giggling and sort of quite eruptive noise throughout that. But I think at times there's a sense that they are laughing at these people from a point of sort of seniority and superiority. There's a bit of, oh, look at how stupid and vulgar these people are. I can't believe how crass and idiotic makes me a little bit uneasy.
Well, this is kind of symptomatic of our attitudes towards sort of American popular culture in the late 80s, which was just basically, isn't it awful?
It's a load of trash.
Yeah. Actually, I think, Ian, you mentioned during the beauty pageant footage that it's kind of reminiscent of something from The Simpsons.
Power roll! Making it work! Gasping for air! I want to be a sweetie pie.
Absolutely. It's just the type of programme that you would see spoofed,
yeah,
which the family would be watching on television and making fun of themselves. Yeah.
Liddy, a new one-hour Monday through Friday confrontation talk show hosted by G. Gordon Liddy.
Actually, the next item in the show is something which would have sat very happily within The Simpsons as a spoof. It's this character, G. Gordon Liddy. Now, how would you describe him?
Well, he is a shady character.
Yeah.
He's a bit thuggish. He's a bit forthright. I knew the name, and I would have known the name at the time, from the Watergate scandal.
He was one of Nixon's sort of aides.
Cronies, I think is the word you need.
He was one of those people who took the rap for Watergate. But as so often happens when people sort of do, you know, get embroiled in bad things, he kind of builds a whole career out of it.
The Watergate break-in may have been a failure, but from Liddy's viewpoint, everything that followed has been a raging success.
So he's sort of building this new career as a sort of media personality. He's fronting his own combative talk show. He's got a career as an actor. He's appearing in Miami Vice. He's appearing on quizzes.
It's superb. Password. Our special guest this week, G. Gordon Liddy.
He's also got a kind of side career as kind of he's leading his own sort of anti-kidnap. You know, if you get kidnapped, he's got this sort of mercenary brigade who will come and rescue you.
If you are snatched by the competition, and your bosses come to me, we will rescue you.
Can you imagine the pleasure that Clive would have felt when one of his team came into him that week and said, okay, Clive, we've got G. Gordon Liddy for this week. And he would have thought, great, that's it.
Don't you think there's something bizarre about TV viewers being asked to tune in to hear a convicted felon conduct a discussion show?
Well, I think if all they were going to get was a convicted felon, you might have a point. But they're also going to get someone who was the youngest bureau supervisor in the FBI at the age of 29 and at 39 was in the White House, who's run for Congress, who's been there, who's done just about everything that can be done. And as a result, knows something of this world, and people are quite interested in what I have to say and comment on it.
He responds very well to Clive, doesn't he? He's got the gift of the gab, hasn't he? Even when Clive sort of addresses him as, you know, a convicted felon, yeah, it kind of bounces off him.
They're a good match, the two of them, because even though they are just going through again a sort of pre-scripted banter, it's very pointed,
yeah,
from both sides.
Yes, yeah.
Both give as good as they get.
But the kind of interchange is almost rapid fire, isn't it? Clive will just say,
"Tell me about your armed anti-hostage squad, Hurricane Force. How much do you charge for their services?"
See, the question itself, that's you can imagine they probably had a big session.
Yeah.
Now, this question here is such a hilarious question.
the greatest question of all is,
has anyone ever tried to kill you?
G. Gordon Liddy responds by saying,
"It seems to happen rather regularly. The last attempt was on 23 December 1987.
And that clip that we see of his show.
I used to be against the electric chair. I still am. It's not big enough. I'm for the electric bench.
It's extraordinary.
It appears to be taking place in some sort of like a bullpen or a courtroom with.
It's very adversarial,
mob.
Isn't it? Yeah.
There's a big mob of people all thronging around him. And just to compound all this, another point we see flying into shot some captions.
Well, they're like headlines, aren't they?
They're sort of arbitrary headlines. About moral panics and things that presumably
someone's
are.
Very worried about homosexual police.
We get
the impression.
Airport police. I've got a 9 a.m. flight.
No problem.
Good.
What airline?
Alaska.
Alaska.
So what comes next? It's basically a kind of succession of adverts, which Clive brands as the BBC commercial break. I think the conceit here is that kind of, you know, he's sort of almost deregulating his own show. So there's not a lot to say about this section. Clive just shows us some American adverts for airlines, and we sort of laugh at them because they're very different to kind of sort of traditional sort of polite British advertising, but that's it, and they're just left to sort of stand in their own right. So then we come to the finale of the show, which, as you said earlier, was kind of always a guest in the studio next to Clive at the desk. And there's something about this section of the show where Clive, sort of in the company of the guest, he sort of tries to sort of tie together all the disparate sort of elements of the show. So in this show, the guest is Peter Ustinov. So Clive immediately talks to him because he's a kind of cosmopolitan citizen of the world. Clive opens by talking to him about kind of those airline adverts.
The yellow cab reminded us it's always a hassle getting to and from the airport, isn't it?
Yes. Well, my latest experience of that was in the People's Republic of China.
You asked him about kind of global TV and the TV that he's watched on his travels.
Yeah.
You know, well, you are Russian, but you know Russia well. You do go back, huh? You watch the TV when you go there?
Clive kind of pivots at this point, doesn't he, in the programme, from being the front man and being the sort of the star or our commentator to sort of playing a stooge.
He's basically the feed
just
here,
just queuing in anecdotes from Ustinov, which I'm almost certain have been arranged beforehand.
Again, there's not a shred of, there's not a speck of spontaneity. But again, it doesn't really, I don't think Peter Ustinov really catches fire here, does he? He never kind of...
No, sadly, he doesn't really fit with the rest of the programme, which has all been quite, there's been energy, there's been a sort of a sense of excitement and a bit of, ooh, what's that? And then Ustinov appears. And, I mean, I suppose it's in his nature. He's a bit of a lugubrious fellow. But the pace of the programme really slows right down.
I think some of his anecdotes are quite lengthy, aren't they? Kind of, and you're kind of struggling, kind of... remember what he was talking about in the first place.
Well, I was in... I remember having to drive to Monte Carlo. I drove all the way through the night for some charity do. And I got to the hotel, thought I'd have breakfast before falling asleep. I could still hear the car's engine and all that.
There's a reference, which is which I think provoked gasps from us, where he's relating a very unnecessary story involving... It's one of the Latin American countries,
Guatemala, isn't it?
And he says...
And there are five children in one room, one of them retarded inevitably. The woman, like a mass of bones, the man who gets drunk on an eyeglass full of weak beer.
And it's really off kilter with the rest of the programme.
It's not great, is it? I think one of the things about this show, and Peter Ustinov is sort of representative of it, is that everyone who appears is a middle-aged man.
That's true. That does lend it the feel of a old boys' club, really. A little bit... supercilious, I think. It's the fact that I'm only allowing people onto this show who are kind of a bit like me. They share share my moral outlook. I have affinity with these people. The more you think about it, the more it really stands out. There's not a woman to be seen, other than unfortunately in the woman and daughter.
That is slightly unfortunate, isn't it?
We think the human side of Dr. Owen deserves more attention, so we're going live to him now. Can you hear me, David Owen?
Yeah.
Your achievement has been described as the greatest resurrection for 2,000 years.
I mean, don't go over the top.
I believe you and your friends are having a bit of a knees up tonight. Who's coming?
Everybody, all the workers, Fiona, the whole lot.
Fiona too, huh?
One thing we should mention before we finish, and that is, Clive is a really good performer.
He absolutely is. He's got great timing. He's got sort of great confidence. He's really relaxed. He delivers a line perfectly.
A real snappy performer.
Yeah,
he's got energy, which keeps the whole thing ticking over very
He really
nicely.
Drives the show.
And if our Sinclair satellite know-how is up and running, he should be just coming into view in Los Angeles.
One thing I wanted to ask you, Ian, about watching Saturday Night Clive in 1989, do you think back then the world seemed like a bigger place?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And this is why it's so evocative to see this now, because you are reminded of how the world was changing in the late 80s, early 90s. Technology was opening it up to you for the first time. And you really depended on programs like this to introduce that world to you and to help you make sense of it, really, because you wouldn't have seen or encountered these sort of faces and images and sounds and senses, really, anywhere else. But yet suddenly they were all rushing in. I mean, the programme makes a virtue of this in its whole format, this idea that it's receiving signals and images from right around the world.
But all that stuff just seems so kind of exotic and foreign, for want of a better word.
Well, helped also by the fact that even the quality of the picture from American television is so, it's so unusual.
Smudgy NTSC.
It's so weird to UK eyes.
Yeah.
And I remember that so well. It's like it's coming from a different planet, out of the stratosphere, with these curious programmes with their strange-looking people on them. It's just true, though, don't you think?
Yeah. Absolutely.
We've lost all that now because the world is...
the world seems a smaller place.
It's a smaller place, yes. That's very true, yes. Now it's my turn. Chris, the programme I've got for you starts straight away.
Okay.
I don't need to tell you anything else about it, right. So here we go.
Well, Friday People.
Yep.
We've got some jazzy music. We're seeing a succession...
Faces.
Of famous faces,
or
some more famous than others. Well, I'm quite happy to be watching Friday People, presented by Mike Smith.
Well, we've just watched an edition of BBC One's entertainment magazine show, Friday People, which was shown on February the 1st of 1985.
Yes.
So we've gone from Saturday Night Clive to Friday People. We've stepped back a day.
Yes.
First thing I want to ask you, Chris, is about the name of this programme, Friday People. I thought, when I saw this, that the name applied to the type of person who appeared in the programme, that they are somehow of a piece, they're of a category, a Friday person.
Mm.
But you said that you thought that it was just a general
term. I thought it's a programme about people... And it's on Fridays, and so that hence the title.
I didn't
think of Friday People being a specific genre of
a category of person.
Yeah.
During the opening credits, we see a sequence of famous faces, and my understanding was that these were all Friday People. So I'm just going to read out the names.
Okay.
Do you agree that these people belong in the category of a Friday person?
So you just want me to say yes or no to whether they are a Friday person?
Yes. Are these Friday people? Okay. Lenny Henry?
Yes.
Cliff Richard?
No, I don't think he is.
Barbara Streisand?
No.
What night's she?
Saturday.
Saturday, of course. Mike Reed?
No.
What's he doing in there? He's not Friday.
Well, he's a morning person.
Yeah, and also Saturday on TV at this time, Saturday Superstore. Tracy Ullman.
Yes.
Les Dawson.
No.
Is there any day of the week that you'd associate Les Dawson with?
I think he's a Monday.
Monday?
Yeah, because he's kind of sort of that workaday sort of...
Oh, I see. Kind of wash day Monday, back to work.
Yeah.
Okay. Joan Collins.
Yes.
Saturday, surely.
I think maybe she be.
Any day of the week.
Ian, let me ask you, can you be a Friday person and a Saturday person?
Well, I suppose for Joan, maybe the weekend starts Friday and just goes right through to Sunday night.
That's my impression.
Okay. Stevie Wonder?
No.
No? Okay. No. And finally, Penelope Keith?
Definitely not.
Friday People then, Showbiz Magazine.
Yeah.
Yep, presented by Mike Smith.
Yes.
Going out at 5:30 on Friday, so just between the end of children's programmes and the news.
Yes.
So I think by default, its tone is very, what would you describe it,
light. Frothy.
Yes, perfect. Lots of short items.
Yeah. It's one of those shows that you can just tune in halfway through and it doesn't matter.
It's designed to something to be sort of dipped into.
Yeah.
You don't have to watch it to the end.
Sure.
There's plenty of items quickly, one after the other. We should dwell upon Mike Smith, Smitty.
Yeah.
How big was he in 1985? Where are we in the Smitty timeline?
He's been doing the Late Late Breakfast Show. Sort of Noel's second in command.
Right.
He's on Breakfast Time as their pop correspondent and also as a deputy presenter. So Mike was kind of big news.
He was on the up at this point, was he? Top of the Pops as well. And this would have been, therefore, a prestigious slot for him, or just another thing, really? I suppose just to boost his profile a bit more.
It's difficult to know kind of what kind of the BBC sort of plan for this show and kind of, you know, what ambitions he might have had. Because, as we said earlier, it's 5:30, which is a good slot, but it's not a prime time slot, is it?
That's true, I suppose. It's just another thing to add to his string to his bow.
I mean, perhaps we should say that this was the first and only series of Friday People.
Sadly, it didn't last. Yeah, it ran through to about May or June, I think. So it had the air of a permanent slot. But then, I don't know, I guess other things happened and decisions were made to not return this particular format, which is a shame because I think Mike Smith does a good job.
Oh, I think he's an excellent presenter. Actually, we should say at this point, in the credits, it states, written and presented by Mike Smith.
That's interesting, isn't it? He's not simply the presenter. And it does have a vague sort of editorial air from Mike throughout. He keeps interjecting. He refers at one point to Angela Rippon.
Heading back to the land of the sinking pound.
He has a cursory remark about
ZZ Top meeting Tom Brooke and how generous it was of Tom to buy them a round of water.
One thing that struck me, and I think you felt the same when we saw the programme, was how tiny the studio is.
It's minuscule, isn't it? We possibly think it might be Pres B.
Which in layman's terms, is...
It's just a presentation studio, right, isn't it? I mean, there's probably nothing that you don't see on screen. That's the whole of the studio. You just see the whole of the studio on your screen. And also it kind of bears one of the hallmarks of a sort of mid-80s magazine show in that every feature has its own little title sequence.
Yes.
So when Mike decides it's time for the competition, we get a little animated sequence which just says the competition. Yes. And when we get an interview with ZZ Top, we get a little kind of title sequence that says music.
If you were to compare it to a magazine of the time, it's not in the league of the face, is it, in terms of style?
No.
Is it more sort of smash hits?
I think it is. It's kind of smash hits, sort of Times, a sort of tabloid newspaper,
a kind of the sort of pull-out supplement you get on a weekend.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In a tabloid.
Yeah.
I think the style and the look and the feel of the programme is so mid-1980s.
It can get any more 1980s. This is peak 80s.
Well, how would we sum that up then? What is it about it which says mid-80s so much?
Well, it's pink. There's a lot of pink going on. It's designer, isn't it?
Oh my god, I mean
Mike's wearing a designer suit, he's sitting in a designer chair, he's got, you know,
designer coffee table next to him,
tiny,
almost too small to have coffee on it,
right? Just the whole look of it is kind of, you would have said at the time, it's very coordinated.
Oh god, yes. And Mike's shirt is done up to the top, there's no tie. The chairs they're sitting on look rather uncomfortable because they're over-designed.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing about which Victoria Wood would have done a sketch, I think, because it is so recognisably of its time and therefore looks terribly dated now, which is unfortunate because if you ignore that side of it, ignore the look of it, everything else in it, I think, holds up pretty well in terms of being sort of bog standard reporting and news discussion.
If you were doing a half hour show business magazine now, it would be roughly similar to that. I think there would be some kind of sort of some obvious differences, but kind of the format, the structure of it, it would be exactly the same.
The address, as ever, is Friday People, BBC Television, Centre House, Wood Lane, London W12, 8QT.
I think one big difference is that nowadays it would be full of social media and how to interact with the programme.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it's very noticeable. This is, a lot of it is simply Mike Smith relating information to us.
He's kind of telling you when a play is starting or when a film's kind of coming on release.
And when your favourite BBC programmes will be appearing. It's like a sort of bulletin board on screen about what is happening in the media.
Obviously this is a pre-internet era where, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that, you know, Wogan's going to be starting his new thrice weekly chat show in a few weeks. You know, nowadays we'd be primed with that information in advance. It wasn't necessarily like that then.
This week saw the first major programme changes to be announced for this channel since Michael Grade became controller last summer.
One of the segments of the show is a discussion about the new look BBC.
Yes.
Now, of course, nowadays we don't get these sorts of things. We don't get channels announcing a new look or revamping themselves public way.
No.
But it did occur to me, I wonder how many people watching would have thought, oh my goodness, the Two Ronnies is taking the place of Dallas next week. You better make a note of that, dear. Write that down. We don't want to be caught out.
Yeah.
There's an element of possibly over-egging this whole BBC One new look.
I'm not sure about that, because that was a massive deal at the time, I think. And there was a lot of press chat about it. But I think kind of people, you know, at large were kind of fascinated by the kind of, you know, I mean, this was the first time that the BBC had done a sort of all-year-round soap opera, wasn't it? Although, interestingly, that's just thrown away in this edition.
But the big change is the shift to chat and soap opera. Every night at 7 p.m. from February the 18th, maybe forever, we get EastEnders two nights a week, and on the other three nights a week, Wogan. Is that what we want?
That is curious, isn't it?
Now, all the focus is on the fact that Terry Wogan is going to be doing a chat show three times a week.
Terry Wogan seems to be never very far away from these podcasts, and he turns up again in this programme, interviewed on film.
Yeah.
By Peter Fiddick of The Guardian.
Now, Ian, is Peter Fiddick a Friday person?
Oh, now...
Because I was expecting someone like Nina Mishkoff
to do
that report.
I think Nina ticks the Friday box much more than Peter.
I was surprised to see him, but he kind of...
Brings some authority to us, doesn't he? He is the equivalent of today's expert. He's he's the journalist from Fleet Street.
Yeah.
Who's gone along to the BBC press launch about this new look on behalf of Friday people.
Yeah.
So it's the BBC. It's almost like they've had to get around the fact we can't really have the BBC talking to the BBC, so let's get someone in from outside. You said while we were watching that you always get a little bit uneasy when Terry Wogan is interviewed about himself.
I think that if you have no talent, apart from whatever talent is required to present a television show, but if you've no specific talent, it's hard to be overexposed.
I think he sometimes comes off as a bit dismissive of what he does. It's almost kind of a bit of a humble brag, and kind of, oh, what I do is nothing special. It's not heart surgery.
Yeah, he's not good at being articulate about his position within the TV industry.
He comes off slightly earnest, which is a marked contrast to his normal TV persona. So I'm not keen on sort of seeing him within that scenario.
He is an extraordinary phenomenon, Terry. He is that rare piece of talent that appeals to absolutely everybody that watches television. Anybody who watches television, no matter what they do, where they come from, where they are. I've never heard anyone say they don't like Terry Wogan.
Because it's 1985 and it's about the BBC, we see, don't we, in his office,
of course,
Michael Graves.
Resplendent.
Yeah.
Looking very relaxed, at ease, dealing with questions very competently, very, very much in control. And there's this sense, we've talked about before on these podcasts, of how there was a period of time in the 80s when the BBC promoted this idea of a big family, where everyone who worked at the BBC knew each other, was always popping in, or knew everyone was going. And this appears several times during this programme.
Yeah.
Not just this bit where we talk about the BBC launch, but also...
But I understand it was Ronnie Barker's idea in the first place, because he does carry quite a bit of weight at the BBC here, and he actually carries quite a bit of weight everywhere. But
Ronnie Corbett, it's almost like he drops in to see Mike Smith halfway through the programme.
Well, you do sort of kind of imagine that he's sort of been plucked from, you know, from his dressing room.
Well, he's gone into the canteen. Has anyone got 5 minutes?
Just before they're about to record the Two Ronnies, and he's been sort of seconded for a bit of a chat with Mike.
I think it's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
I think I miss it.
Yeah.
This idea that everyone's together and they all know each other, and if they need to help out on another show, they just nip their next door for a quick chat. And Ronnie really comes in purely just to talk about the scheduling. And also, it's almost like, well, while you're here, Ronnie, can you judge this competition about celebrity photos?
Yeah.
Some good contenders there.
Very, very good, yes.
And we should say that the sort of rationale behind this appearance is the fact that the new series of the Two Ronnies had been sort of...
Parachuted in. To the Dallas slot.
To the Dallas slot, because this was the period where Dallas had been poached, to use the correct tabloid term, by Thames Television. And the BBC kind of decided that we weren't going to admit defeat, so they kind of put the two Ronnies into the Dallas slot.
It's a fascinating reminder of how big a deal this sort of thing was back then, that Mike Smith can just refer to the Dallas Wars and without any other explanation, and assuming that you'd know what it was all about.
Oh, definitely.
That's Angela Rippon, and this is one of her reports on a combat workshop designed to train people how to direct fights in movies.
There are a number of features that pepper the programme.
Yes.
Alongside the studio-based items, such as the Ronnie Corbett thing. We get Angela Rippon. She's out in America, but she's coming home.
She's coming home. She's been on a sort of, is it Boston?
It's
she's
Boston
been on a news
station.
Channel in Boston. Yep.
Only for a year, but she's already had enough and she's on her way back.
While she's been in America, Angela's style of reporting appears to have changed. She is far less formal on air than she was in Britain, and at times more demonstrative.
You were Brigitte Bardot?
1969, yeah.
It's a rather, I think, a slightly dismissive report from Tom Brock, because he says he thinks that Angela has become more demonstrative as a presenter.
I
thought, well, what's he getting at here? And Angela, to be honest, she doesn't come over very well in this little slot. We see her doing some perhaps rather undignified things on this channel, like attending a sort of a lesson in how to stage fight sequences for TV programmes.
Yeah.
But then at the end, we're told she's coming back, although there's a vague air of slight pointlessness about it. She's not coming back to be on the news. I was expecting it to be, oh, she's coming back home for a big deal with the BBC. Instead, she's coming back, what for?
I'm not sure, really. I think in 1985, Angela Rippon had still a bit of currency. I mean, Mike talks about it being 2 years since the launch of TVAM, which she had initially been involved with. So I think there's still quite a bit of public interest in, well, what's Angela Rippon up to?
That's true, yes. And Mike did say it was nice to see her face again.
And that's it?
Yes, that's virtually it.
Well, I don't have a normal day, you see. I mean, it's not an unusual sort of thing, but I mean, I don't have any routine. I'm always being asked, you know, how do you spend your Sundays? Well, Sunday, I suppose, is the one day I do have a sort of routine in that I don't do anything.
Another one of the filmed segments is A Day in the Life of Julie Walters.
Yes.
And I think we both remarked that as soon as she appears on screen, she is Julie Walters. She's immediately on, isn't she?
This is the first knockings of National Treasure Julie Walters, isn't it?
She's not quite there yet, but she's sort of...
The kernel is there.
Yes, she's
the seed
establishing
is there.
The idea of being... Oh, she says it as it is.
Down to earth, lovable.
Speaks her mind.
Yeah.
Unpretentious.
Yeah.
We see a...
It's almost like she's part of your family.
Yeah, we see her rushing between various engagements. She's in the back of a taxi with Sarah Green, moaning
about... She's
so
busy that she has to be interviewed in the back of a taxi.
Lovely. Thank you.
And there's a nice moment where we see her arrive at Broadcasting House.
You can't
go
wrong.
And I mean, this just is a reminder of how much... So many resources are being thrown at this programme. There's a film crew with her in the taxi. There's one waiting for her outside when she arrives in the taxi.
Yeah.
There's another one in the studio at Broadcasting House with Gloria Hunford when she arrives there. I mean, this is no expense spared here for this day in the life.
Welcome Julie Walters to the studio. Julie, do you always bring these people with you, all 13 of them?
Well, I don't know where they've come from, Gloria. I'm sorry, I was minding my own business, doing my shopping this morning, and what happens? These people are... I'm sorry, but I'm going to call the police. Really. Don't touch my clothes. I'm sorry.
Okay. At one point, Gloria Hunford actually refers to there being some, like, 13 people in her studio just for this item.
Yeah.
But... I mean, I think it's kind of worked because Julia Walters and Sarah Green, I mean, they have a sort of they're quite conversational.
Yeah.
Although at one point Sarah Green sounds a little bit still like sort of Blue Peter Sarah Green.
This is very much still Blue Peter Sarah Green, not Saturday Superstore Sarah Green, isn't it?
Well, next stop for Julie wasn't exactly the gutter, but the Cottesloe Theatre at the National for that evening's performance of Fool for Love. Before she went on stage, I asked Julie what the play dealt with. Well, oh God, millions of things.
Yeah, if you fast forward a few years to going live, Sarah Green, I would say that she's much more sort of relaxed, a bit more freewheeling, not quite as, well, what would be the word? She's a little bit patronising towards viewers. She speaks very slowly, doesn't she?
That's trappings of the way that film is made. It's a very kind of old-fashioned way of filmmaking, isn't it? With kind of a voiceover that's been dubbed on afterwards, where she's sort of kind of explaining between scenes what Julie's up to and the play that she's appearing in. I think if you were making that film now, it wouldn't be anywhere near as formal and staid.
You don't get shows like this on television anymore.
Well, it's a sort of periodic obsession of sort of TV commissioners, isn't it? That we should have an entertainment showbiz news magazine, and there are sort of periodic attempts to sort of revive the format, but they never seem to stick around, do they?
It's almost as if they're tried, and then people think, oh, no, actually, that's not really a very good idea, and then they go again and they fall out of favour.
Well, I think, you know, people presumably see sort of showbiz sort of gossip magazines on the newsstands and think, well, that should be on TV. But things like that never necessarily work on TV. But in having said that, I think it sort of stands in its own right. I think it worked as a watchable, entertaining half hour of TV.
Okay, Chris, do you think you belong more with the Friday People or Saturday Night Clive?
I think I'd like to think I was a Friday person, but I think in my heart of hearts I'm a Saturday Night Clive sort of person.
What is it about those two shows that embodies their particular point in the week?
I think Friday People embodies that whole feeling of school's out, the weekend starts here, it's time for a bit of frothy, lightweight entertainment. Whereas I think Saturday Night Clive falls at that point in the weekend where you're ready for some entertainment, some satire, some comedy. It's very much a sort of main event kind of show. You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched Saturday Night Clive from the 4th of March 1989
and Friday People from the 1st of February 1985.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.